This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh, and the morning run begins. It's a scent away, taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by tweeting us at BFM Radio or WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899. It's the 27th of March. We're coming up to the end of the month and perhaps for many of us, payday. To bring
That's
us joy.
Right, Shira. Good morning. How fast time flies.
It does. On a monthly basis, it does fly quite fast.
And we're going into the second quarter of the year already.
That's true.
And tax filing season.
Yes, I look forward to that. Okay. Some news that perhaps we missed while you were resting overnight, and because you need your rest, it's very important to get good sleep. A rhino census has begun in the Indian National Park of Kaziranga. Now, we mentioned this because, of course, we remember the story of the dying rhino subspecies yes. in Sudan. And so this is another case of a rhino and the efforts being made to protect the species.
Yes, so in the last survey in 2015, authorities counted about over 2,400 rhinos, up from the 2012 results. So that's a positive. Can see that that has been progressing there. And actually, that park there is, that national park in India is well known for how they protect their animals there. And actually, the park shoots people to protect rhinos. Apparently, there was
a
story
on
that.
They shoot people to protect rhinos.
Yeah, this was
rhinos.
A 2017 story about how if they are poachers. Just to protect the animals.
Just making human sacrifices for the sake of it. Now, in Pakistan, Pakistan Television had the first transgender anchor in its history. So, Marvia Malik, who is a student of journalism, and also was a model, has been the first transgendered person to be hired in what is essentially or seen often as a fairly conservative country.
Yes, Sharad, she anchored her first show on Friday after 3 months of training. And, you know, I mean, transgender people, they face discrimination in Pakistan and many struggle to find employment there. Some are forced into begging, dancing or prostitution to earn money. So this is a big step, a huge step for them there. And she was really, really happy for what has happened and how it has turned out.
Okay. Yeah. Also big news, and we see the spiraling of the situation following the poisoning case in Britain. Many European nations, as well as the US, have taken punitive measures against the Russians. The Russian diplomats have been expelled across the US and Europe. In fact, I think it was 60 Russian diplomats expelled by Donald Trump in the US.
Yeah, more than 20 countries have aligned with the UK, expelling more than 100 diplomats. Russian diplomats, that's a lot.
And, you know, because the Russians have defended themselves, saying there's thus far no proof that ties them to the particular murder. Now, Nestle is launching a new lower sugar milk bar made with a new version of a sweetener that could help the $185 billion confectionery industry's growing public health headache, meaning people are concerned about their health and they're perhaps eating less sugary stuff, especially those that contain unnatural sugars.
So these are what? Milky Bar, Walsams, and apparently these new bars have 30% less sugar than a typical chocolate bar and are basically helped by the use of Nestle's new ingredient, sugar, that has been physically altered to be lighter and dissolves faster.
Yeah, I don't know. What does it dissolve into your brain, perhaps? You know, there are a lot of artificial sugars out there that apparently are said to be very bad for you, like aspartate and such. But that's a conversation for the Health and Living Show. We'll be back with a look at a homeless Prime Minister. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me at Joyce Goh, and that was Black Betty with Ram Jam, or rather by Ram Jam. I'm Sharad Kutin. Again, we're starting the morning run, taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock in the morning. have a look, as we promised, at a prime minister who's without a home. Now, he doesn't come from a poor country. This is Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's afraid to ask taxpayers to fix up his moldy official residence. Since 1951, the country's prime ministers have lived at 24 Sussex, which is a 34-room limestone mansion in Ottawa. But Justin Trudeau has taken up residence somewhere else in a neighbouring estate, part of the Governor General's or the Queen's representative in Canada.
Yeah, sure. So the problem is that 24 Sussex, where he's supposed to live in, is too run down to house his family, his wife and three children. But he does not want to take, you know, the political heat for approving repairs. And the official residence is, guess how old? 150.
Yeah, okay. So it's very old. And I think the last time it had repairs was in the 1970s. So it's due for renovations. But the question is, when it comes to the public perception, mm-hmm. and, you know, and this is not true all over the world. In some parts of the world, leaders are very careful about using public monies, especially when it's lavished upon them directly, right? So they're circumspect about using, say, personal jets to fly here and there.
That's
or
right.
They're concerned about the way in which the cars are used. So, you know, we have a conversation in Malaysia about the use of the national car. I mean, do our leaders prefer foreign-made cars, or do they, you know, in fact, go for the
Malaysian-made ones?
Yeah.
Well, Justin Trudeau actually said that no prime minister wants to be accused of spending taxpayers' money to make his life more pleasant. So that's pretty interesting how he made that comment, and it's very nice of him, I guess. I guess it also depends on the person, the personality, right, and how they feel, whether they feel that
what they want to project of themselves,
correct? Isn't it? So, yeah, and the message that's coming out,
absolutely. But I think that also there is the other side of the story, which is that this is not something that is lavished on them personally, because they don't take it with them when they leave the job.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that's going to be used for, say, the next 70 years by successive prime ministers. So it's really going to belong to the state. It's an investment that the government makes in its own infrastructure. I'm not quite sure whether guests of the Government of Canada are also housed there. Why would you need such a large house? I mean, 34 rooms is quite substantial.
It's huge.
Yeah, so then the question is the use that house is put to and other functions that might happen there and such.
Yeah, it could be you could use it to entertain or have meetings as well. Apparently, the house needs an estimate of 39 million ringgit in repairs. That's a huge sum. And basically, some of the paint is lead-based and the place is already infested with mice. And the ceilings and walls are impregnated with asbestos. And basically,
it sounds very toxic. So the question, but coming back to the question of should, say, a prime minister, in this case Justin Trudeau, but any prime minister, any leader, you know, whether they're president or prime minister, should they be given some sort of leeway? Should the public actually take a chill pill and say, well, this is not going to them personally, it's not enriching them personally, it's about the infrastructure, especially when, you know, what would be involved in, say, for instance, entertaining guests? You want the country would want to put their best foot forward, wouldn't they?
Yeah, but maybe for the PM right now, for the prime minister right now, he says, I do not want to be that prime minister to make that big renovation and take that bill, to take that hit. Because if you look, the biggest renovation that was done most recently was 70 years ago, 70.
Oh.
Yeah, so I guess maybe for a sitting prime minister, you're like, oh, I don't want to be the next prime minister.
So is he being selfish? I mean, is he just being, in some sense, self-serving? He sounds like he's self-sacrificial because he's not, helping himself by creating a much more comfortable environment. But in some ways, he's pushing off, he's kicking the can down the road, right? Kind of in using that proverb. He's not taking responsibility and he's hoping the next prime minister does what needs to be done.
I mean, that's just one possibility why he doesn't want to do the repairs right now. But 39 million ringgit repair bill is quite a big bill.
Well, you know, because what is it denominated in Canadian dollars? Mm. I think the important thing is that to recognize that, look, if we use the logic that Justin Trudeau is using, which is that he's not going to do it, and what if every successive prime minister does not do it, then what you'll have is essentially this house collapsing in on itself.
That's
while
right.
they take up residence somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, but it is really old. It's 150 years old and it definitely needs some repairing. And if they don't do it, like you say, it might just
collapse. And yeah. Maybe what they need to do is figure out whether this house needs to be decommissioned and move into a much more modest house
right.
for future use. Mm. Well, something that Canadians will have to decide. But if you have a point of view on this, you can always WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Stay tuned. We'll be back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Little Uneasy by Phaser Days, a project by Amelia Murray from New Zealand. I'm sure I could with me, Joyce Goh. And time to talk about feeling uneasy, especially in your job. Something that apparently happens or gets more intense after the age of 35. This is according to a survey that was done of British workers. One out of six British workers over the age of 35 say they're unhappy, and that that rate of unhappiness doubles for those. That's double those of
those under 35.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's right. Mm.
And nearly a third of people over 55 said they didn't feel appreciated, while 16% said they didn't have friends at work, Sharad.
They didn't have friends at work. Mm. Well, that might be the responsibility, not your boss, but something about yourself, really. Okay, the issue, of course, is that is this such a counterintuitive result? I mean, that the longer you stay in the job or in working life, the more likely you are to be tired of the routine, tired of what you're doing, feeling that there is, you know, in fact, there's very little that excites you anymore. I mean, so would you be surprised by these results?
Not really. I think also because of out of work responsibilities that increases as you get older, there's like the house mortgage, that car loan or the kids, you know, there are a lot more things that as you grow older, then you add on, and then it's no longer different as
right,
when
so
you
this
just
external,
started.
Right.
Yeah, external things that also adds on to the work stress that you have on top of that. Because like when you're 21 or 22, you just started working, it's just work, right? And then after that, you go out work, you go clubbing, or you go meet your friends, lepa, have a Ayer Limau at the Mama. You know, there's so many other things you can do, no?
But yeah. Produce. So the question is, because stuff that is internal to the job, what the survey notes is that people also get stressed out by taking up higher positions. So they get managerial supervisory roles as they grow older. That's a cause of stress. And even though they're likely to be well compensated or compensated for those additional responsibilities, that's not enough to kind of take the edge off their unhappiness. And they still remain unhappy despite the higher remuneration.
Yeah, and the survey also says like true salaries are higher, but life starts to get more expensive. And a work-life balance starts to mean taking care of children rather than just personal stress management. So there are a lot of other things that as you get older, it's different. The situation is different.
Do you think you could ever get tired of being a journalist, Joyce, of chasing the stories, of talking to people?
I miss chasing the stories.
Okay. Mm. Do you think you could ever get tired of it?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe because you're so young.
Depending on what's the story. No, I mean, but I am tired. I mean, honestly, I am. As a working mom, it is tiring.
Right. So as a working mom.
Over the weekend, my kids were sick.
Right.
And my allergies flat up, so yeah.
Okay, so those again are things that are external to the job. The things that are about the job. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, I was thinking about this, whether as somebody in radio whose job it is to have conversations or be part of conversations or talk to people, whether I would just one day say, I really don't want to talk for the
really,
first part
Sharad,
of my morning.
Do you think so?
I wonder about
I think
about
you
it.
Enjoy your job, though. Do you enjoy your job?
I do. So even though I'm well past 35, and I think of several other kind of notable journalists in radio, for instance, Studs Terkel, very well-known American radio journalist who spent much of his life, late into his life, into interviewing Americans, right? And, you know, from all walks of life, telling their stories, helping communicate that. It doesn't seem, at least from the face of it, from, you know, that he ever tired of it.
But yeah, so it depends on also the job. Do you think it's because, is it the job factor or is it because, like, the actual job or is it about going to work that this survey is looking at? Because you're saying 35 and above, people tend to hate, what's the actual headline there? People start hating their jobs at age 35. So that's the actual headline.
Okay, so this might be a bit of clickbait. I'm sure part of the reason that they actually, you know, I mean, and these are just aggregates anyway, right? 35. I don't think there's something magical about 35. But let's just assume that at 35, you would have, having gone to university, you've now spent more than a decade at work, right?
Yes.
In some job, maybe several jobs by then, you know, especially if you're young and you move jobs a lot. But the point is, you'd already get over that initial excitement about getting into the working world. And
was there excitement for you when you started work? Because I remember I was like, oh my goodness, is this the working world? When I first started my job at an accounting firm. And I remember I was like, because I had so much expectations perhaps. And I'm like, this is the working world? I
have to be in the office. Disappointment?
Yeah, kind of. 6 months in. I mean, the first 6 months was a total shock for me, like commuting to work, being stuck in a traffic jam after getting into work at 8 and trying. I thought, you know, working would be so cool and all. You know, I first started out having to just fax things and typing the CP204 forms. Those are the tax forms. You know, but that's the realities of work when you first start. But it's very different from what you have in your head. You know, I'm going to an accounting firm. I'm going to be, you know, having meetings, meeting clients, but no Joyce. But yeah, I mean, but it's good. It's good grounding.
But, you know, wasn't student life also a preparation for that? There was some level of...
I enjoyed my student life. Mm-hmm. I miss my student life. I miss my uni life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the question is, you know, having that, the routine, because of 10 years of routine, you know, is it too early? I'm not quite sure. Tell us what you think. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Stay tuned. Stay tuned. In fact, taking us to the first bulletin of the morning is Electric Light Orchestra with All Over the World, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Pearl Jam with Soldier of Love. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, a Joyce Go, and the morning run continues. It's 39 minutes past 6 in the morning. It is the 27th of March. Earlier this month, Joyce, we celebrated International Women's Day. We had several panel discussions. We had a whole week of grills with women in positions in the corporate world, in the activist world and such.
We did.
Yeah. And the question is, you know, how do we take that conversation, which is actually a global conversation today, how do we take that issue of women, if you take, for example, you know, the gender pay gap and stuff, how do we take that conversation forward?
Well, sure, we're having an event that's happening tomorrow, Wednesday, March 28th at 6 p.m. in Alia KL at Bukit Kiara. Basically, it is where you can join fellow leaders and entrepreneurs to discuss how game-changing women can press for progress in what has been a male-dominated business world.
Right, so that's a hashtag press for progress.
Yes.
Yeah, and so interesting because we're looking at how women specifically, not legislation, not larger society, not men, but how women become the game changers in this interesting conversation that is happening globally.
That's
now,
right.
To sign up, remember there are in fact limited seats for this event, just 60 people or 60 vacancies. You can visit www.bfm.my/network series. For more information. Now, let's turn our attention to the question of public transport. We have lots of transport-themed discussions later this morning, especially with the Grab-Uber merger, as it were. And we'll leave it up to, you know, for that discussion for later. But turning to the question of public transport, according to the Deputy Finance Minister, Dato Othman Aziz, the MRT project needs to meet the target of some 250,000 passengers daily to break even. It's not quite getting there, is it?
Yeah, they're currently recording between 130,000 and 140,000 passengers a day. And he said that MRT is a long-term project, not one that could generate a return of investment in a short period. So right now, there are six stations that have yet to be that have yet to be fully completed and utilised, namely Kuasa Damansara, Kuasa Central, Kampung Selamat, Sungai Buloh, TRX and Merdeka 118.
Now, the question, of course, is how do we get people to take public transport? I take public transport because I don't drive. I don't know how to, right? So perhaps I'm not a typical case. Mm-hmm. What we're looking at is people who can drive and do drive and take, other forms of private transport. How do we get them to change their behavior and take public transport? You, for instance, you drive. Would you ever consider becoming a public transport person?
I would if it's convenient and the time spent, from where I live to, like, for example, here, is short enough compared to driving. And also the accessibility of the stations. In this case, it's MRT that we're talking about, right? So basically, how accessible is it? How long does it take for me to get there? Can I get a car park when I get there? How long will it take? Because do you know that our BFM video team, they did a study in a way. They sent their intern for 30 days. He tried on the MRT, and from where he lived in Ampang to where our studio is in Bandar Utama, guess how long does it take him one way?
I couldn't, what, an hour and a half, maybe?
Average 90 minutes.
I got it right.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, I wasn't even looking at my notes.
Average time travel time is 90 minutes one way, Sharad, from Ampang to where we are.
Yeah, but if you drive and you get caught in a traffic jam, I'm always having friends who are lamenting, while they leave the office at 6:30 and they're stuck in a jam for an hour, right?
Taking the train too. Also at 6:30, it's jam-packed. It's like sardines. Have you tried? It's really... chock-a-block in there.
And that's
as well.
True of most metropolitan cities of the world. You think of Japan, you think of all these, right? So why should we pretend, why should we kind of like want the public transport to be some sort of magic carpet that, that sweeps us of our feet and takes us home?
Well, speaking about Japan and public transportation, at least timing is quite consistent, right? So in this video that the BFM video team did, what the intern found out, what he found out was that the bus schedule was inconsistent. Consistent. Yeah. So he ended up sitting in the bus waiting for the bus to move. So you kind of waste time there in a way. Also, the cost. So cost of one way for him, the travel cost is about 870 one way. So if he works out to about for a whole month, it will cost him about 522 ringgit monthly to take public transportation to work. That's
what
for
do you pay
days.
In car park fees? Just car park fees. Never mind petrol.
Well, 25 ringgit a week.
Is that all? 25 ringgit?
It's 5 ringgit
so
a day.
So 100 a month.
That's because we start early and we get those spots where you only pay 5 ringgit a day.
So what about, so for somebody who takes private transport, they have their own car, they'll have the parking fees, they'll have the patrol. How much you spend on patrol a month?
It depends on how far you drive.
Right.
And
then
the
you have
distance,
maintenance
right?
as well
yeah,
for your
that's
car.
True.
Right? So I think when you say, well, it's 522.
No, I'm just saying what they found out, basically. Yeah.
But the question is that extraordinarily high compared to having your own car?
I think for public transportation, you would expect it to be lower a bit. I mean, it depends on public. I mean, it's public transportation. It's not like a private car or private hire. Like you take Grab. Public transportation, I don't count the ride-hailing Grabs and Ubers and all that. Our public transportation is bus where you or MRT and LRT, right?
So how much cheaper do you think people would want it to be them to make a
This is one way though. So this is 870 one way. Maybe 870 for both ways.
Also
it depends on where you're coming from. I think he's from Ampang to Biu. Sorry.
What I'm saying is that, so if the issue is the cost of it, would that be enough to convince people to make a switch to public transport? Tell us what you think. WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Sly and the Family Stone with Everyday People. I'm Shara Kutin. With me, Joyce Goh. And the Morning Rhyme continues. We were talking about public transport. Inche Gan has weighed in. Make sure the system for public transport is efficient enough and fares are not so expensive. He's saying that will make him change his commuting habits, maybe giving up his car and getting onto public transport. Now, if you have views, remember, you can always share it with us. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789 or 8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. In fact, we have a WhatsApp message that's come in. It says, CJ says, I think cost is definitely an issue. I'm driving a hybrid average around for about 75 ringgit. And I pay about 2.6 ringgit for toll, a total 300 ringgit a week to get to work. Another reason I tend to drive is the nearest train station is about 8 kilometers away from where I stay, and the roads are quite congested. So, okay, well, everybody's got practical reasons why they've chosen their own, mode of transport, and because the last mile issue is quite big. But if that was solved, would people still give up their cars?
Well, when it's solved, I'm sure many of us will. It really boils down to, as all of them have said, also connectivity, cost, accessibility, all of that we take into consideration.
Right. In fact, we have another tweet that's come in, WhatsApp that's come in that says that somebody switched from KTM to MRT, that in their commute, there are different modes and different systems of public transport. The MRT has trumped KTM, at least for that person. Thank you so much for your comments. Now, we move on to another aspect of urban life, which is the fact that some people fall through whatever social safety nets they are and end up homeless. But there are, in fact, initiatives to help them out of that situation of homelessness.
Yeah, so there's this saying that goes, give a man a fish and you feed him a day, teach him a man to fish and you feed him for a lifetime. So basically, this is what Yellow House KL is doing in a way, right? A backpacker hostel which helps the homeless through a program called Unseen Tours KL, where street people are trained as tour guides to show tourists around KL.
Yeah, Yellow House Kuala Lumpur founder Syam Paria said that he believes in sustainable help. I believe that actually it's a woman. She believes that it's a sustainable way to help people get off the streets and to give them some sense of purpose. Yellow House manager, tour guides fees for such tours, the unseen tours, okay, it's interesting because it's a split between the guide and the program. So the guide gets 60% of the fee and the program gets 40%.
Yeah, so aspiring tour guides are also paid a small token during their initial training sessions in an effort to motivate them. And this is also to help them understand the pride in holding down a job and earning their own keep. I think there are currently 5 tour guides running Unseen KL Tours who earn an average of about 500 ringgit monthly.
Yeah. So, I don't know if you've seen these videos, Joyce, that are on YouTube of homeless people and the various countries that these videos are taken, playing piano, for instance. And there was a very famous young man, I believe, in the streets of Ireland, who, not so young, I think he was in his 40s, he had mental health issues, he had other issues, ended up on the street, but he seemed to have this piano, and he actually composed some original music, and it's extraordinary. It's got millions and millions of hits on YouTube. And this is something I guess we don't expect of people who are homeless, that they have talent. We see them as sort of derelict. We don't think of them as having both potential, maybe even having a context from which led them to that situation.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are a number of them, even musicians. And I've seen one that's a balloon talent guy where he makes balloons for bubbles out of nets for kids. And the kids loved it. And then he will collect money from the parents, of course. But they do have talent. It's just we do not know the circumstances behind why did they end up homeless.
Okay, to get more insights into the issue, we spoke to Munira Abdulhamid, who runs Pertiwi Soup Kitchen. We asked her about the challenges in ensuring that the impact of these programs can be sustained for the long term, as most homeless people tend not to hold on a job.
That is the problem, you see, because you have to understand the problem they're in, yeah? Sometimes when you really hit rock bottom, there are many obstacles. And sometimes you become set in that kind of lifestyle. To get out of it requires a lot of discipline. If you find a job, that's a 9-to-5. That's not going to be easy. You have to be prepared to get up and go. So we started by giving the readiness program. I mean, they're qualified. Some have diplomas, degrees, that sort of thing. So they can be hired and they want to work. But the minute you are working, it means you have to be in the office early, dressed, and prepared to work all day. So to change whatever lifestyle you've had for a while, for a few years, it's not going to be easy. Very few actually manage to hold down the job. Yeah, the rest will say, oh, it's too hard. I cannot do that. So we tried to find something which is more suitable. Perhaps some of them, they like to be in F&B. And F&B can mean being waiters or something like that. And you can start at a later shift. That may work. But it still means you cannot suddenly take MC or disappear or things like that.
That was Munira Abdulhamid from Pertiwi Soup Kitchen.
Well, interesting. She actually said some of them, I mean, they have diplomas, they have degrees, you know, at the end of the day, it's just discipline and whether they can come to work and hold a job.
Yeah, but yeah. I'm not quite sure about, you know, sort of putting the blame on them like, oh, you know, they, if only they were more disciplined, they, you know, they could move forward from their situation. Often people, it's complex reasons that lead someone to be homeless. I don't know, very few people choose to be homeless. Mm. I mean, you know, and so mental health issues might be one of them. The fact that they don't have a supportive network, that, you know, families have abandoned them or friends have abandoned them. So so those things can't be put together just by sending somebody off to work. I mean, you know, and I think perhaps, you know, a little more sympathy and generosity is when it comes to kind of thinking about what their problem, but certainly a question of engaging with them.
Yeah, it means, yeah, it's the circumstances. We do not know what are their circumstances they are in. They want to work. That's what she's saying, right?
We're coming up to the next Bulletin of the Morning and taking us there, Iron and Wine with The Devil Never Sleeps. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Good morning, I'm Shira Kutin, with me, Joyce Goh, and the morning run continues. It's just 7 minutes past seven, and it's the 27th of March. We were talking earlier, Joyce, about public transport. We had quite a few people weigh in. KH Lim, Mediocre, WMHWA, that's actually a name or somebody's handle. Juwen Lee is also weighed in, and they're suggesting everything from increasing parking fees to introducing an Oyster card, where when you the more you travel, the more discounts you get when you travel on public transport.
Good idea.
So thank you so much for all your suggestions. The question is, you know, can we move the story forward? Because we've had a lot of talk about public transport, everything from the last mile, and we still haven't had any resolution on that score.
Slowly but surely, hopefully.
Well, yeah, one can remain optimistic. Things obviously have changed over the last 20 years for the Klang Valley in terms of public transport. Now, let's take a look at the Malaysian inside. You know, I think everybody was shocked when news came out that it was stopping, that basically it was halting publications because, as they put it, they missed a major milestone in starting a paywall and that page views traffic had not reached the targeted critical mass. And editor and CEO Jaba Sadiq said that the publication will be reviewing its direction, news operations and commercial viability. They had a town hall with their staff yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad for the whole media industry as a whole. At the end of the day, I think it's not just in Malaysia, it's a global thing. Everyone's trying to figure out the right business model to be a sustainable news organization. At the same time, you also want to produce good content, but you also need money to sustain that business, right? So it is a very tough balancing act to find, to actually do.
Yeah. In fact, on the last Pressing Matters that we had, not yesterday's, but the week before, we spoke to the editor of what we believed was an ongoing section in the Star newspaper, Eco Watch. And but when he came in, he told us that actually that segment of that he had helmed for 2 years had just been closed down. And we know, of course, the expectations, or at least there's a lot of talk about culling that's going to go on at the Star. We already had one round of culling. We expect reduction in numbers of people there as well. So, that, again, that story of newspapers having to rationalize their operations. And because the human side of that story, Joyce, you know, people like you and me, journalists, losing our jobs.
Yeah, it is scary. And the thing is, sometimes I feel that when you get consultants in to give you advice on the business model, on what you should look to cut, how do you look at cost and look at revenue? But yet, at the end of the day, sometimes as a journalist, the job of a journalist is something that you have to be on the ground to know what is the job, what it entails to go get the story, to make sure you get the right story. It's a different kind of thing. I'm not sure if a consultant is able to understand the job scope, unless maybe if they follow the journalist around and then you can put a figure to it and say, oh no, you should cut 400 journalists just like that. I'm not sure if that is what it is, you know?
I think often because consultants are there to perhaps deliver the bad news. Organizations bring in, you know, external consultants. You know, I'm not responsible for this plan. Mm. They are, you know, take it out on them. Okay, now to get in some insights into the issue of paywalls, which is the subject of the Malaysian Insight explanation for why they're shutting down, we turn to Lau Chak On. He's the editor-in-chief at Chili Sauce Malaysia. For now, Chili Sauce hasn't put up a paywall, so we asked Chak if he would consider doing it, and are Malaysians ready to pay for news?
Okay, so actually we've asked our readers before about whether, when we published last time about the Malaysian Insider closing down, I believe a few of our readers actually said that if Chili Sauce put up a paywall, they would actually pay for it. But we still feel that this is a very small part of the overall audience, and it wouldn't be enough to actually sustain it. Because we actually pay our writers quite well, we pay our freelancers quite well, so I'm not sure whether a paywall would be sufficient. The problem with a paywall is that because everyone else offers their content for free, if one blogger offers a paywall, then basically everybody will go to other places. So it makes it quite difficult to do a paywall for one person. Also, the nature of content these days is that we access everything via Facebook. So we don't go just to one site. We go to like 18 or 20 sites, you know? So very few people will pay for one site and not pay for the other 17.
Now, we asked Chuck if the ad revenues are enough at the moment to cover expenses at Chili Sauce.
I think they're okay for us. I believe some people are doing better and some people are doing worse. But for us, we would say it's sustainable for now. I do believe that news organizations are having a lot of trouble with this. So because they have much higher staff counts, right? We have quite a small team, so it's a lot easier to maintain. And also news is getting harder and harder to monetize, whereas the type of content that we do can still be quite easily monetized. The problem with that is that news organizations are the ones going out there and reporting stuff and getting information. People like us are basically just digesting it. So there was an analogy that I put in the original Malaysian Insider article, which is that the news reporters are kind of like the farmers, right? So they go out and they get the food, the real information. People like us are like restaurants, you know, we'll prepare the food for you if necessary. Mm-hmm. But without the farmers, we have no food to prepare.
Now, we asked him about the question of mindsets and people who take online news for granted, especially when they're given that they read it for free. How do you change those mindsets?
Okay, so actually there's something that I was planning to do after my time here at Chili Sauce, which was a kind of shared paywall among various publishers. This actually is something that is very much in the early stages. But I believe that if a paywall were to be implemented, it would have to be across several sites, not just one, unless that one site is really so important to you, like let's say Wikipedia, you know. In fact, the only one I can think of is Wikipedia. Nothing else is part of a daily diet that would actually help this. There's another thing that actually someone else told me about, which is quite interesting, which is that every time you log into a site, that site actually gets your permission to do some Bitcoin mining in the background. So that Bitcoin mining actually contributes to the income of the site. So this actually would be quite cool as well. But then it will also open itself up to like a lot of scamming and a lot of dodgy stuff with your computers and stuff. So it's a very difficult place to work with. I think right now we're just seeing the initial impact of dropping revenues across the board. And it's going to get worse before it gets better.
That was Lau Chak On, Editor-in-Chief at Chili Sauce, speaking about paywalls for online content. Do you think paywalls are the way to go, Joyce?
Well, in a way, yes, if you need to monetize the content. But whether or not people will pay, that's another thing. Remember my chat with Dr. Wong Sai Wan on the Breakfast Grill a couple of months ago? This was on media and the sustainability of media and how he spoke about people are just so used to free content now that not sure if they're going to pay. And he predicted that this year in 2018, there'll be a number of job cuts for the media industry because he foresees that publishers will need to cut jobs because revenue is just not coming in. And you can listen to that if you download the app, our BFM app.
There's also a question of loyalty and a lack of loyalty these days. In previous time, we tended to be loyal to particular media organizations, and you know, we develop with them a particular worldview and we trust. These days, it's kind of everywhere, and you can take anything or nothing at will, right?
That's true, but I feel like trust is also very important as a consumer of content right now. You need to trust the publication or trust the where you're getting your content from because there's just so much content out there and so many different platforms, right?
I think people trust themselves and Facebook, and that's about it. Okay, we'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.